Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. A little over a month ago, on October 7th, Hamas militants launched a major attack on multiple locations across Israel, killing both civilians and military personnel and taking hundreds of hostages. Israel has responded with extensive bombing campaigns that have devastated the densely populated Gaza Strip, as well as a ground invasion of its territory. Over 11,000 people have been killed in Gaza by the Israeli military's action since the war began, and that's according to the Palestinian Health Ministry. While Israeli officials have revised their death toll from the October 7th attacks to around 1,200, along with over 200 hostages taken. The fighting has also drawn attention to the challenges of maintaining human rights in the conflict area, particularly in Gaza. Increasingly forceful calls for a ceasefire or humanitarian pause, allegations of war crimes or crimes against humanity, and rising concerns about anti-Semitism and Islamophobia here at home. Days after the initial Hamas attack, Professor Keith David Wattenpah, the director of human rights studies at UC Davis, provided an initial analysis of the conflict. Professor Wattenpah returns with a deeper look at the human rights challenges of the current war. Professor Wattenpah, thanks for the time.
Thank you, Vicky. It's wonderful to be here.
So you were on Insight in October, as I just mentioned, days after the initial Hamas attack and Israel's retaliation. Here we are 5 weeks later. How are you feeling? How are you processing everything that's been going on?
So I come back to as part of to express the concern that I have and that many other specialists in human rights and genocide studies have, that there's mounting evidence of crimes against humanity and violations of war crimes in Gaza, that the death toll seems to indicate to us that Israel is failing to live up to its obligations under the Fourth Geneva Convention to take all precautions necessary to limit civilian casualties. So I'm here to talk about that and help us understand how human rights as an analytical technique can help us make sense and to get to some of the reality behind these terrible numbers that we're seeing.
I mean, there's a lot of severe and emotional words that are being used to describe what's happening, especially what we see in Gaza right now. Words and terms like ethnic cleansing, apartheid, war crimes, and genocide. But these words also have real, distinct definitions. What are they?
That's correct. So one of the things that we do at Human Rights Studies at UC Davis, is that we train our students to look for the warning signs of genocide. We feel an obligation as scholars in this field to really call out these warning signs in an effort to prevent genocide from happening. And so over the course of the last several weeks, we've been seeing many of what we consider sort of evidence of genocidal intent being expressed by the leadership of Israel. So just pause for a moment. Genocide is an international legal term. It means the destruction of a people, but there has to be behind it the intent to destroy a people in whole or in part. And so we're seeing that in statements from Israeli leadership, from the president of Israel, the prime minister of Israel, to retired generals who in many ways are thought leaders in the country, saying things like what General Giora Eiland said just a couple weeks ago, creating a severe humanitarian crisis in Gaza is a necessary means to achieving the goal of victory. He also wrote, Gaza will become a place where no human being can exist. And when we see the accumulation of statements like this, we're very concerned. We're very concerned that there, what is now a armed conflict can transform or tip very easily into ethnic cleansing and then move from that into full-scale genocide. Mm.
Given that you're a human rights professor, has it been challenging to talk about what has been escalating and unfolding, given understandable emotions that can be at odds with each other? I mean, this all stemmed from October 7th. I mean, it's as if, you know, people are viewing what's happening and escalating death toll through different lenses and different perspectives. Is it tough for you to talk about this as a human rights professor?
It's not tough for me at all. Human rights is a very stable, usable framework for understanding the violation of people's basic rights to life, to dignity, to health. And it's not difficult to talk about it. In fact, we're driven by two core values, which are empathy and consistency. So on the one hand, we seek to understand how people are traumatized and negatively affected by what's happening in the world around them. When we look at these violations of human rights, we look at what's happening in Gaza and in Israel, we use the same standards that we'd want to use if these violations were happening in the Western Hemisphere or Ukraine or in Pakistan or in East Africa. So no, I don't find it difficult to call out the violations of human rights.
How should people talk about these situations, use the right language while recognizing the immense destruction and human suffering?
So this is where I want to get back to this idea of empathy and consistency. And these are not sort of just kumbaya terms. These are terms that are based on real laws, real international laws that have been put in place since the beginning with the end of the Second World War. And the most important of these is the Fourth Geneva Convention. So at the end of the Second World War, the global community got together and they looked at what had happened around the world. They looked at Nazi atrocities. They looked at attacks on civilians. They looked at the Holocaust and they said, this can't happen again. And so a body of law, a body of international law was created that has a very unambiguous core idea, which is that during conflict, civilians are not to be targeted, and that militaries, and I don't care if it's the Israeli military or the Hamas terrorist organization, that they must take special precautions, that's the word that's used, to minimize civilian casualties. And with a death toll in Gaza now coming close to 12,000 people, nearly 5,000 of whom are children, and over 3,000 of whom are women, it's becoming very difficult for me as a human rights scholar to really take seriously Israeli statements that they are not engaged in practices that are putting civilians in unnecessary harm.
Yeah, there have also been calls among some people in positions of power for both a ceasefire and or a humanitarian pause in the fighting. What is the difference between the two?
So ceasefire and humanitarian pause, neither of which have sort of standing under an international law, right? So very much they're in the eye of the beholder. A humanitarian pause in this case means an effort to stop the fighting temporarily so that supplies could be brought in. A ceasefire usually takes place in anticipation of negotiations for peace, right? That and a military like Israel is loath to agree to a ceasefire until it has achieved its war aims. I think we have to note that most of the countries of the world have asked for a ceasefire. And only a handful of countries, including our own, have stood in the way of an official United Nations call for that.
Well, the White House recently announced that daily humanitarian corridors were agreed to by the Israeli government. But do these fit the description of a pause? Are they actually helping civilians in Gaza?
So I think that the best way to think about the impact of these humanitarian pauses is to think about the situation at Ashifa Hospital, the largest hospital in Gaza, a very modern facility with doctors who are really well-trained, nursing staff and so on, who are facing a situation where daily people are dying under their care because of a lack of electricity, a lack of medicine. We've all seen the pictures on the cover of the New York Times of premature babies being huddled together in order to keep them warm. We also know that dialysis patients, chemotherapy patients are unnecessarily dying because of the lack of very simple things like electricity. And Israel, under international law, is also bound to take special precautions to make sure that hospitals are not attacked and that basic needs of hospitals are maintained. And in my saying this, I'm not saying anything different than what President Biden said this morning as well.
Hmm. What about the killing of members of the UN agency in Gaza? That's the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees. In addition to journalists, the Committee to Protect Journalists, as of today, 42 journalists and media workers were confirmed dead, 37 Palestinian, 4 Israeli, 1 Lebanese, 9 reported injured, 3 others missing, 13 reported arrested. You know, aren't these individuals, and with the UN Relief and Works Agency, as of this week, 102 staff have been killed. Aren't these individuals, civilians, protected under international humanitarian law?
Absolutely. More UN officials, more UN workers have been killed in the last month than in the two decades before. So these are 101, 102 That's updated from last night when I looked it up. Humanitarian workers for the United Nations Relief Work Agency have been killed. And what does UNRWA do? That's what we call it. These are teachers. These are administrators of programs. These are social workers. These are nurses. These are daycare workers. These are people who help civil society in Gaza exist. And with their death, they're going to be absent from any effort to rebuild Gazan society. So this is a terrible blow to any effort for Gazans to rebuild, to have the dignity of access to, for their children to school. Yes, the Committee for the Protection of Journalists noted that 42 journalists have been killed so far. But also, you know, as a university professional, I'm interested and concerned about what's happening to higher education in Gaza. The Palestinian Ministry of Higher Education, located in Ramallah, has told us that 427 university students have been killed so far, including 12 academics. And the reality is 88,000 young people in Gaza and the West Bank are not able to attend university right now. Again, denying them a basic human right, which is a human right to education. So we're looking at a situation where the Israeli decision to invade and attack Gaza in the way that it has provides mounting evidence that it is violating international human rights and humanitarian law. But what it's also doing is destroying the civil and the civilian infrastructure of Gazan society, which will create a very difficult situation for Gazans once peace comes, if it ever does. Mm-hmm. And so all of these things combined tell us that the situation on the ground in Gaza is that Israel is acting in a way that is disproportionate to the threat, which is another key human rights legal doctrine.
You're talking about a scale of loss that can be difficult, if not impossible, to fully comprehend. I mean, especially when people are taking in an increasing death toll, you know, over 11,000 Palestinians reported in Gaza by health officials there, around 1,200 in Israel, according to authorities there. Are we really able to understand the gravity behind these figures, right, behind these numbers?
So as I said, there's this, you know, key idea in human rights studies of empathy and consistency. So consistency, we really want to understand the numerical and the data-driven impact of what's happening. Empathy is when we try to understand the human side. And we talk often about this phenomenon called the numbness and dumbness of numbers, the numbness and dumbness of numbers, meaning that when we're confronted with these large numbers, we as human beings just don't have an opportunity to understand the real-world impact of what those mean. And so we always have to remind ourselves that behind the 4,600-plus number of children are parents, are mothers and fathers, many of whom probably were also killed alongside their children. We have to understand what it means to a society to lose doctors, to lose teachers, to lose college students. We have to understand this, and I think we have to understand how this impacts Israeli society as well, that this is why, after the end of the terrible events of the Second World War, we created this system, right? And that we created this system to hold all nations of the world accountable to a very basic standard. And unfortunately, it appears that Israel is failing to adhere to the basic standard.
And all of us are taking it in. I mean, it's easy to find, you know, constant developments, understandably so, also on social media. The imagery is devastating. How do you recommend people engage with staying up to date on what's unfolding and what's escalating?
I think this is a really wonderful question, and I don't have a great answer to this, aside from listening to NPR. But I think that when we permit ourselves to be deluged by images without comment, especially recognizing that there's a tremendous amount of misinformation that's being promoted, when we listen to unchallenged statements by military spokesmen, Hamas spokesmen, State Department spokesmen, and women spokespeople, we really make ourselves vulnerable to swallowing one narrative or the other. And this is, I work with my students a lot on this, and unfortunately, they get a lot of their news from social media and from TikTok, which is image-driven. And so I encourage people to go to the old media, to spend time with the LA Times or the New York Times, to read the Jerusalem Post, to listen, to read the updates in Al Jazeera or BBC News. I think the most important idea is to multiply your sources of information rather than to narrow them. But again, if you just take in the images, it makes you even more vulnerable to the numbness and dumbness of numbers.
There have also been here at home, also in other countries around the world, instances and accusations of anti-Semitism, Islamophobia. You're a human rights professional. I mean, how should people respond to what's happening, to these prejudices that are taking place?
And again, this is where empathy and consistency is important. Anti-Semitism is real. It happens in American society. It is present throughout the world. Anti-Semitism is hatred and prejudice against Jewish people, but also against an imaginary figure of the Jew. It's a very old prejudice that seems to be very difficult to stamp out. And then Islamophobia is a similar pattern of fear and hatred, where there is prejudice and discrimination against Muslims, but also against Arabs. And it's important to understand that that there are Christian and Muslim and Jewish Arabs around the world who are facing similar acts. And what brings these two ideologies together, and this is one of the things that has generated our concern about genocide, is that at their heart it's a dehumanization, right? And we know when we study war crimes, crimes against humanity, ethnic cleansing, and genocide, that one of the very first things that takes place is the dehumanization of the other, because it becomes a lot easier to kill them, to deny them their humanity, to deny them their dignity. So it is real. It is real, both anti-Semitism and Islamophobia on campus and in American society. But one of the things that we're concerned about as human rights professionals is where the accusation of either anti-Semitism or Islamophobia is used to suppress legitimate speech, especially the legitimate criticism of the state of Israel, just like we should be able to criticize any state for its actions. And so I have to say, at UC Davis, I've not seen the kinds of anti-Semitism or the kinds of Islamophobia that I've seen at other campuses.
I was going to ask, you know, as an academic, you're on campus at UC Davis. At other colleges across the country, including here in California, there have been demonstrations and protests that at times can conflict with each other. Students can have different views and conflict and be at odds with their own professors. You know, can you give us a sense of what the environment is like at the UC Davis campus?
So first, I think it's wonderful when students are at odds with their professors. Right. I think it's wonderful when students can have civil discussions, can take a stand, are willing to protest, to demonstrate, to help other people understand their position. And I think we've been relatively successful at UC Davis in making sure that kind of environment is available to all. In fact, last night I had an opportunity to have a conversation with the leadership of the Students for Justice in Palestine, which is one of the leading sort of advocates for Palestinian rights. On other campuses, other chapters, primarily large private universities driven by private donations, Students for Justice in Palestine has been banned from campus, and that's certainly not happened at UC Davis. And they report to me that they feel that they have no major complaints, that the university has not provided them with a legitimate space for protest. They've raised concerns about surveillance by other students and other student groups, but also have identified moments when they have been exposed to hate speech and so on, but not to the degree that I think is happening elsewhere. And I think one thing that's very important to understand about what we've been able to do through human rights studies at UC Davis is that several of the leaders of Students for Justice in Palestine have taken my genocide courses, and they have engaged in the formal study of anti-Semitism, the Holocaust, other genocides, and really, I think, have understood, this is the empathy part again, the collective suffering of the Jewish people in the past, and recognize both strategically and intellectually how anti-Semitism is ultimately also destructive to their cause.
Professor Watson-Paul, as always, thank you for the conversation.
Thank you very much, Vicky.
Keith David Wantonpaul is a professor and director of human rights studies at UC Davis, and he's discussing the human rights challenges during the ongoing Israel-Hamas war, which has entered its second month. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.